Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary, for speaking with Voice America today. I would like to start with your take on President Biden's recent remarks on Taiwan. A couple of days ago in Tokyo, he indicated that the U.S. would defend Taiwan militarily if China attempts to take Taiwan by force. White House officials walked back the remark, later saying the president was only promising U.S. aid to help Taiwan defend itself. And then President Biden himself clarified that the U.S. hasn't changed its strategic policy on Taiwan. Do you think it's just, President Biden misspoke a little bit, or it's indicating that the administration is seriously considering ending its strategic ambiguity on Taiwan?
Well, first of all, it's great to be with Voice of America today. So thank you very much. Look, I think President Biden's remark was very important. It, in my view, constitutes a change in policy. It's not the first time he said it. It's, in fact, the third time. And it's also the third time that the White House tried to walk it back and explain it away, which is confounding to me and many others. Look, I've said before that I think that the One China policy in the decades since relationships were changed in the 1970s has run its course, that Taiwan and China have developed and evolved in different ways that now warrants a new approach, a new policy. And I think that there's less ambiguity today than there was before with regard to whether or not the United States would defend Taiwan. So I think President Biden made a clear statement. Now, of course, he doesn't get into the details of whether that means troops or just logistical support or whatnot, but he wouldn't be able to offer that anyways. It all depends on the situation and what else is happening at the time. But I view it as a policy change. I think it is warranted, and I give him credit for making such a bold statement.
In your newly published book, Secret Oath, you argue that the time has come for the U.S. to review its One China policy. Are you suggesting an end to the strategic ambiguity on Taiwan?
Yeah, I think it makes sense to move beyond ambiguity to clarity. And by the way, I wrote the book a year ago. It's just now coming out after DoD reviews and whatnot. And my view is, given the situation in the Taiwan Strait and the fact, frankly, that China's approach toward Taiwan has been very threatening, we've seen over the last several years, we've seen Chinese naval and air movements into Taiwanese airspace, and we've seen heated rhetoric. So, look, they are not abiding by a core foundation of One China policy and at least the Taiwan Relations Act and communiques, which basically said that all parties agreed to that the future of Taiwan should be resolved peacefully. And by the way, in the Taiwan Relations Act, as I recall, the law actually states that were either party to try and address the future of Taiwan in an unpeaceful means, and we would consider that a grave security threat, which implies that there would be a U.S. military role.
But given the strong reaction from Beijing, is it possible to change the U.S. policy on Taiwan without provoking armed conflict with the PRC?
Well, that's a challenge, and that's a challenge I wrote about in my book. My preference would be that a change in policy not be done through a press conference, but rather it first be done behind closed doors with our greatest partners and allies in the region, that it be coordinated, for example, with Tokyo and Seoul and with Australia and the Philippines and others, and that it come out in a more deliberate manner with providing sufficient strategic context, explaining the reasons behind the change, and so on. And so that's kind of what I argued for in my book, a more thoughtful approach, a more deliberate, and a more coordinated rollout. But obviously, he got asked the question, and the president was candid in his remarks and in his views. And as I said, he stated it three times now over the past several months.
Speaking of possible armed conflict with the PRC over Taiwan issue, the U.S. military has been working for years on the operation plans for such contingency. In your book, you talk about a war plan that has been constantly updated. So even though Washington has been intentionally vague about whether it will come to Taiwan's defense if Beijing attacked, the U.S. military is very clear about what to do at each stage of a Taiwan contingency. There is no ambiguity about that, right?
Well, the United States military prepares plans for any type of contingency around the world that may involve U.S. interests and could involve the United States military. So that's part and parcel of our day-in, day-out planning. Obviously, we've known since the relationship has changed, and obviously since the new turn that China has taken under Xi Jinping, that there is a possibility of conflict in the Taiwan Strait, and by the way, in the South China Sea and other parts of the world as well, with various other states. So you have to plan and be deliberate about it because that is the responsible thing to do.
About the plan, of course, it's classified. I assume we cannot review too much about it, but could you at least tell us if the plan, when you were in charge, of course, included sending troops to Taiwan? If so, under what circumstance?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't talk about DoD operational plans.
So let me ask you this way. According to a recent survey, over half of Taiwan residents do not believe the U.S. would send troops in response to a Chinese attack. The share has doubled compared with before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What messages you would like to send to those people as a former U.S. defense secretary?
Look, I think any country that's under threat from a neighbor or somebody else first and foremost should rely on themselves for their self-defense and not others to come to their aid. I've said publicly that I think Taiwan needs to do more to improve their defenses. I think they need to invest more of their GDP as a percentage into their defenses. I think they need to expand conscription, both in terms of the breadth and length. I think they need to look at different types of arms purchases to take on a more asymmetric defense, such as we've seen in Ukraine. So I think first and foremost, Taiwan needs to rely on Taiwan and not think that the United States or another country is going to come to its aid. Because in my view, a population that is organized and trained and equipped to push back against a bigger power is a far greater deterrent than leaving your fate to somebody else.
So in fact, there are other ways to defend Taiwan military against China's invasion without actually sending troops to Taiwan, right? For the U.S.?
Well, there are many ways to defend. More importantly, there are many ways to deter. And so much of that depends really on the stance that China takes at the end of the day, is what does China plan to do and how do they plan to do it? And look, I would encourage Beijing, as I have over the years, to work with the government in Taipei and improve relationships and have discussions about these matters of concern to Beijing in a peaceful diplomatic manner and not threaten them with overflights of fighters and bombers and the sailing of warships into their waters.
I'm wondering, how urgent is it to have this kind of discussion? How do you see PRC's readiness to take over Taiwan by force?
Well, only the PRC military really knows, the PLA, People's Liberation Army, knows how ready they are. And but there's consequences, right? It's a risky proposition. They have to, depending on what their plans are to do such a thing, and there are risks and there are consequences. And I think what Beijing has seen based on Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that the consequences of a unwarranted Chinese assault or action against Taiwan could result in economic isolation, political isolation, and have a dramatic impact on the Chinese economy, to say the least.
As you've just pointed out, since Chinese President Xi Jinping took office, there has been a significant buildup of China's armed forces. In your book, you talk about China's development of land-based ballistic and cruise missiles. Do you find it particularly threatening to the U.S. and to Taiwan?
Well, every country has the right to defend itself. I just make a point of the fact that they have over 1,000 or so missiles on the mainland opposite Taiwan and other areas. And that's something, if you're a planner, you have to take into account. It's just a fact of a critical element, I think, of China's defense that has to be factored into those of us who are concerned about China's ascent.
You also mentioned that PLA's missile system were integral to China's anti-access or called area denial strategy for the Western Pacific. What's your assessment of the strategy of China? Why do you call it a major obstacle for the U.S. to overcome if we ended up in a conflict?
Well, it's been the view, and I think that China has stated it, that they want to control the waters within the Nine Dash Line. They claim it as territorial waters going back historically, but that uncovers waters and areas claimed by several other countries in the Western Pacific, from Vietnam and Indonesia to the Philippines to Japan and elsewhere. So they want to control that first Nine Dash Line, the first island chain, and clearly get out to the second island chain, which involves many Pacific island countries, and control those waterways. And look, those waterways aren't for China to control, number one. Secondly, Chinese control of those waterways would have a dramatic impact on international trade and would affect many, many countries, not just in the region, but around the world. So, look, I'd go back to the basics. I want to see a China that continues to grow and thrive and prosper, but does so within current international rules and norms and frameworks, and not doesn't try to break them or bend them or violate them. And we've seen too much of that over the past many years. And that's the issue we have.
So how would you compare the maritime capability between China and the U.S. nowadays?
Well, in terms of capital ships, warships, I think the United States Navy is the best in the world, hands down. But China is growing its Navy in terms of size and capacity and capability. And it's something we have to be alert to. That's why I propose to modernize the United States military in both its size and capability in dramatic ways if we're going to continue to deter the PLA Navy from whatever plans they may have in the future.
Let's talk more about the specifics on this issue. You know, given the rising military capability of the PRC, what's the right way for Taiwan to build up its own defense? In your book, you mentioned that you pressed the Taipei to spend more on the right mix of forces and weapons. What do you mean by right mix?
Well, I think it begins with building a capable territorial defense where as many of the 23 million Taiwanese people on the island know how to use a weapon or know how to defend their town, their community, their block, whatever the case may be, and they know how to organize if the PRC tries to seize the island. That would be number one. Number two, on the conventional military force, I think Taiwanese military needs to make sure it has the capability to defeat an amphibious assault. That could include anti-ship cruise missiles and mines, but it also means the systems that we see, again, Ukraine using, such as anti-tank weapons, anti-aircraft weapons, handheld weapons that would allow the Taiwanese people to fight in small groups in an insurgent mode, if you will, should the PLA invade.
That goes into the next question I would like to ask. There are reports about the Biden administration quietly pressing Taipei to order American-made missiles and smaller arms for asymmetric warfare rather than weapons designed for conventional set-piece warfare. Do you think it's necessary?
Well, I'm not familiar with, I don't have any inside knowledge, if you will. I read what you probably read, but to me that makes sense. That there be a balanced approach, that it's not just high-end military equipment that's used by a professional military, but also other equipment that could be used by, again, smaller groups of professional soldiers or a militia or a territorial defense. I think it needs to be a balanced approach because, the PLA military is much, much bigger and capable than the Taiwanese military. So what you have to do is figure out how to create a deterrent force of 23 million Taiwanese that would make the possible seizure of Taiwan by the PLA very, very risky, very uncertain, and very very bloody, if you will, should they pursue to do that.
I'm wondering how much of the strategy could be applicable to the U.S. When it comes to build up the U.S. military capability. As you've just mentioned, the Ukraine war has proved the superiority of anti-platform weapons. So some military experts have suggested the U.S. give up its platform-centric view and stop investing heavily in expensive platforms like battle tanks or aircraft. Do you agree?
I agree to some measure. You always need tanks on the modern battlefield. You always need manned fighters. You always need some degree of manned ships. But for example, the naval force structure that I put forth in the fall of 2020 called Battle Force 2045 had much greater emphasis on a smaller distributed fleet of warships, many of them manned or optionally manned or unmanned to do that. Because I believe that the future is going to be in long-range precision weapons that don't require a platform to launch them, but rather can be launched from the mainland or somewhere else. So I think that is where history and technology is taking us.
Besides Taiwan, what are the other flashpoints that might lead to armed conflicts between the U.S. and China?
Well, if you just look in the Western Pacific, there are a number of areas. We talked about the Taiwan Strait. I think North Korea is a possibility. If the DPRK attacks the Republic of Korea, could that war broaden? Obviously the United States would get involved, as would Japan, maybe others. Then you have the South China Sea, where China has laid claim to any number of islands. And then you have every now and then these conflicts pop up in other parts of the South China Sea, whether it's between China and the Philippines or China and Indonesia, other places where their maritime militia is active, and they're trying to lay claim to different parts of the Western Pacific. So I think all those are flashpoints. We can keep going around to, for example, the Himalayas with the Indians. We had a clash there in 2020 between the Indian military and the PLA. So if you look mostly around the periphery of China, at least in the south and east, you see a lot of areas where conflict could break out.
Given there are so many flashpoints, I believe it's your belief that it's very important for the two militaries to improve their communication to reduce the chances of miscalculations. As a defense secretary, you reached out early on to your Chinese counterpart and tried to maintain a pace of communication. You actually talked to Wei Fenghe multiple times. What's your impression of him?
Yes, you're right. I do. I think it's very important that both countries talk, particularly countries that are competing with one another, as we were with China. And I thought it was important that we have that dialogue so that we could prevent misunderstandings, address misperceptions, resolve issues and conflicts and whatnot. So I reached out early on to Minister Wei to build that relationship. And we tried to talk every few months. And certainly if we were in the same place at the same time, we tried to meet. So, for example, at an ASEAN meeting in Bangkok in 2019, we met. And so I think it's very important. He was affable and informed and willing to listen to me, and I listened to him. And we just tried to talk and keep that line of communication open, because I think it's important to build that during a non-contentious period, so that if something happens, that you at least have a level of trust and communication that will allow you to talk during difficult times.
In your book, you said you actually recognized that Wei Fenghe wasn't truly an equal when it came to authority and power in his own system, but he was your best point of entry. We know that China has constantly denied the requests of U.S. defense secretaries to speak to its highest ranking uniformed officer like General Xu Qiliang, right? So are you concerned about this?
Well, I'm concerned there has not been a dialogue or there was not a dialogue between the Pentagon and the Chinese military at the highest levels for some period of time. As I recall, Secretary Austin recently spoke with Minister Wei. Look, at the end of the day, we have differences in our organizations and rank structures. I was willing to talk to Minister Wei because I think it's important to have those lines of communication open. I would prefer to speak to my actual equivalent, but that wasn't the case. But it's better to speak to someone than no one.
Do you think it might reduce the effectiveness of, communication with the Chinese military?
Well, it could, but that's their decision. If something happens and there's a misunderstanding, then that's on them, not me. I tried to reach to the right person, and as did Secretary Austin. And clearly, the Chinese do not want that level of communication for some reason.
What would be your suggestions for the Biden administration to push forward the China focus, especially during the time when the Ukraine crisis seemed to take much of its attention and the resources?
Well, I think the president needs to continue. It needs to have direct contact with his counterpart, Xi Jinping, to explain all of our concerns with China and its behavior, and look for areas not just to compete, but areas to cooperate where we might build some trust and build some bonds. But at the same time, you also have to increase the relationships between our allies and partners in the region, beginning with our bilateral alliances with, for example, Australia, the Philippines, Korea, and Japan, and then work on the partnerships as well, whether it's Vietnam and Indonesia or Mongolia, and build that up and get show American leadership in not just the military context, but also the diplomatic and economic and trade, so that we can stand firm and defend, again, the international rules-based order and norms that have really allowed countries around the world to prosper and thrive and communities to grow now for 75 plus years.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary, for your time.